Chapter 10. June 21st. On the road from Castle to Poprig. Heat, dust, crowds, confusion, all the sordid shabby rear view of war. The road running across the plain between white powdered edges was plowed up by numberless motor vans, supply wagons and Red Cross ambulances. Laboring through between them came detachments of British artillery, clattering gun carriages, straight young figures on glossy horses, long Phidian lines of youths so ingenuously fair that one wondered how they could have looked on the Medusa face of war and lived. Men and beasts, in spite of the dust, were as fresh and sleek as if they had come from a bath, and everywhere along the wayside were improvised camps, with tents made of wagon covers, where the ceaseless indomitable work of cleaning was being carried out in all its searching details. Shirts were drying on elder bushes, kettles boiling over gypsy fires, men shaving, blacking their boots, cleaning their guns, rubbing down their horses, greasing their saddles, polishing their stirrups and bits. On all sides a general cheery struggle against the prevailing dust, discomfort, and disorder. Here and there a young soldier leaned against a garden paling to talk to a girl among the hollyhocks, or an older soldier initiated a group of children into some mystery of military housekeeping. And everywhere were the same signs of friendly inarticulate understanding with the owners of the fields and gardens. From the thronged high road we passed into the emptiness of deserted Poprig, and out again on the way to Ypres. Beyond the flats and windmills to our left were the invisible German lines, and the staff officer who was with us leaned forward to caution our chauffeur : no tooting between here and Ypres. There was still a good deal of movement on the road, though it was less crowded with troops than near Poprig. But as we passed through the last village, and approached the low line of houses ahead, the silence and emptiness widened about us. That low line was Ypres. Every monument that marked it, that gave it an individual outline, is gone. It is a town without a profile. The motor slipped through a suburb of small brick houses, and stopped under cover of some slightly taller buildings. Another military motor waited there, the chauffeur relic hunting in the gutted houses. We got out and walked toward the center of the cloth market. We had seen evacuated towns Verdun, Badonviller, Ranelagh, but we had seen no emptiness like this. Not a human being was in the streets. Endless lines of houses looked down on us from vacant windows. Our footsteps echoed like the tramp of a crowd, our lowered voices seemed to shout. In one street we came on three English soldiers who were carrying a piano out of a house, and lifting it onto a handcart. They stopped to stare at us, and we stared back. It seemed an age since we had seen a living being. One of the soldiers scrambled into the cart, and tapped out a tune on the cracked keyboard, and we all laughed with relief at the foolish noise. Then we walked on, and were alone again. We had seen other ruined towns, but none like this. The towns of Lorraine were blown up, burnt down, deliberately erased from the earth. At worst they are like stone yards, at best like Pompeii. But Ypres has been bombarded to death, and the outer walls of its houses are still standing, so that it presents the distant semblance of a living city, while nearby it is seen to be a disemboweled corpse. Every window pane is smashed, nearly every building unroofed, and some house fronts are sliced clean off, with the different stories exposed, as if for the stage setting of a farce. In these exposed interiors the poor little household gods shiver and blink like owls surprised in a hollow tree. 100 signs of intimate and humble tastes, of humdrum pursuits, of family association, cling to the unmasked walls. Whiskered photographs fade on morning glory wallpapers, plaster saints pine under glass bells, antimacassars droop from plush sofas, yellowing diplomas display their seals on office walls. It was all so still and familiar that it seemed as if the people for whom these things had a meaning might at any moment come back and take up their daily business. And then crash. The guns began, slamming out volley after volley all along the English lines, and the poor frail web of things that had made up the lives of a vanished city full hung dangling before us in that deathly blast. We had just reached the square before the cathedral when the cannonade began, and its roar seemed to build a roof of iron over the glorious ruins of Ypres. The singular distinction of the city is that it is destroyed but not abased. The walls of the cathedral, the long bulk of the cloth market, still lift themselves above the marketplace with a majesty that seems to silence compassion. The sight of those facades, so proud in death, recalled a phrase used soon after the fall of Liège by Belgium's foreign minister La Belgique ne regrette rien, which ought someday to serve as the motto of the renovated city. We were turning to go when we heard a whir overhead, followed by a volley of mitrailleuse. High up in the blue, over the center of the dead city, flew a German aeroplane, and all about it hundreds of white shrapnel tufts burst out in the summer sky like the miraculous snowfall of Italian legend. Up and up they flew, on the trail of the Taube, and on flew the Taube, faster still, till quarry and pack were lost in mist, and the barking of the mitrailleuse died out. So we left Ypres to the death silence in which we had found her. The afternoon carried us back to Poperinghe, where I was bound on a quest for lace cushions of the special kind required by our Flemish refugees. The model is unobtainable in France, and I had been told with few and vague indications that I might find the cushions in a certain convent of the city. But in which? Poperinghe, though little injured, is almost empty. In its tidy desolation it looks like a town on which a wicked enchanter has laid a spell. We roamed from quarter to quarter, hunting for someone to show us the way to the convent I was looking for, till at last a passerby led us to a door which seemed the right one. At our knock the bars were drawn, and a cloistered face looked out. No, there were no cushions there, and the nun had never heard of the order we named. But there were the penitents, the Benedictines we might try. Our guide offered to show us the way and we went on. From one or two windows, wondering heads looked out and vanished. But the streets were lifeless. At last we came to a convent, where there were no nuns left, but where, the caretaker told us, there were cushions a great many. He led us through pale blue passages, up cold stairs, through rooms that smelt of linen and lavender. We passed a chapel with plaster saints in white niches above paper flowers. Everything was cold, and bare and blank, like a mind from which memory has gone. We came to a classroom with lines of empty benches facing a blue-mantled virgin, and here, on the floor, lay rows and rows of lace cushions. On each a bit of lace had been begun, and there they had been dropped, when nuns and pupils fled. They had not been left in disorder. The rows had been laid out evenly, a handkerchief thrown over each cushion, and that orderly arrest of life seemed sadder than any scene of disarray. It symbolized the senseless paralysis of a whole nation's activities. Here were a houseful of women and children, yesterday engaged in a useful task, and now aimlessly astray over the earth. And in hundreds of such houses, in dozens, in hundreds of open towns, the hand of time had been stopped, the heart of life had ceased to beat, all the currents of hope and happiness and industry been choked, not that some great military end might be gained, or the length of the war curtailed, but that, wherever the shadow of Germany falls, all things should wither at the root. The same sight met us everywhere that afternoon. Over ferns and birks, and all the little intermediate villages, the evil shadow lay. Germany had willed that these places should die, and wherever her bombs could not reach, her malediction had carried. Only biblical lamentation can convey a vision of this life-drained land. Why, your country is desolate, your cities are burned with fire, your land, strangers devour it in your presence, and it is desolate, as overthrown by strangers. Late in the afternoon we came to Dunkirk, lying peacefully between its harbor and canals. The bombardment of the previous month had emptied it, and though no signs of damage were visible, the same spellbound air lay over everything. As we sat alone at tea in the hall of the hotel on the Place Jean Bart, and looked out on the silent square, and its lifeless shops and cafes, someone suggested that the hotel would be a convenient center for the excursions we had planned, and we decided to return there the next evening. Then we motored back to Kassel. June 22nd. My first waking thought was, colon, how time flies. It must be the 14th of July. I knew it could not be the 4th of that specially commemorative month, because I was just awake enough to be sure I was not in America, and the only other event to justify such a terrific clatter was the French national anniversary. I sat up and listened to the popping of guns till a completed sense of reality stole over me, and I realized that I was in the Inn of the Wild Man at Kassel, and that it was not the 14th of July, but the 22nd of June. Then, what? A tob, of course. And all the guns in the place were cracking at it. By the time this mental process was complete, I had scrambled up and hurried downstairs, and, unbolting the heavy doors, had rushed out into the square. It was about 4 in the morning, the heavenliest moment of a summer dawn, and in spite of the tumult, Kassel still apparently slept. Only a few soldiers stood in the square, looking up at a drift of white cloud behind which they averred a taube had just slipped out of sight. Kassel was evidently used to tops, and I had the sense of having overdone my excitement, and not being exactly in tune. So after gazing a moment at the white cloud, I slunk back into the hotel, barred the door, and mounted to my room. At a window on the stairs, I paused to look out over the sloping roofs of the town, the gardens, the plain. And suddenly there was another crash, and a drift of white smoke blew up from the fruit trees just under the window. It was a last shot at the fugitive, from a gun hidden in one of those quiet provincial gardens between the houses, and its secret presence there was more startling than all the clatter of mitrailleuses from the rock. Silence and sleep came down again on Kassel, but an hour or two later the hush was broken by a roar like the last trump. This time it was no question of mitrailleuses. The Wild Man rocked on its base, and every pane in my windows beat a tattoo. What was that incredible unimagined sound? Why, it could be nothing, of course, but the voice of the big siege gun of Dixmude. 5 times, while I was dressing, the thunder shook my windows, and the air was filled with a noise that may be compared, if the human imagination can stand the strain, to the simultaneous closing of all the iron shop shutters in the world. The odd part was that, as far as the Wild Man and its inhabitants were concerned, no visible effects resulted, and dressing, packing and coffee drinking went on comfortably in the strange parentheses between the roars. We set off early for a neighboring headquarters, and it was not till we turned out of the gates of Kassel that we came on signs of the bombardment. The smashing of a gas house, and the converting of a cabbage field into a crater which, for some time to come, will spare photographers the trouble of climbing Vesuvius. There was a certain consolation in the discrepancy between the noise and the damage done. At headquarters we learned more of the morning's incidents. Dunkirk, it appeared, had first been visited by the taube which afterward came to take the range of Kassel, and the big gun of Dixmude had then turned all its fury on the French seaport. The bombardment of Dunkirk was still going on, and we were asked, and in fact bidden, to give up our plan of going there for the night. After luncheon we turned north, toward the dunes. The villages we drove through were all evacuated, some quite lifeless, others occupied by troops. Presently we came to a group of military motors drawn up by the roadside, and a field black with wheeling troops. Admiral Ronerk, our companion from headquarters, exclaimed, and we understood that we had had the good luck to come on the hero of Dixmude in the act of reviewing the marine fusiliers and territorials whose magnificent defense of last October gave that much besieged town another lease of glory. We stopped the motor and climbed to a ridge above the field. A high wind was blowing, bringing with it the booming of the guns along the front. A sun half veiled in sand dust shone on pale meadows, sandy flats, gray windmills. The scene was deserted, except for the handful of troops deploying before the officers on the edge of the field. Admiral Ronerk, white-gloved and in full dress uniform, stood a little in advance, a young naval officer at his side. He had just been distributing decorations to his fusiliers and territorials, and they were marching past him, flags flying and bugles playing. Every one of those men had a record of heroism, and every face in those ranks had looked on horrors unnameable. They had lost Dixmude for a while, but they had gained great glory, and the inspiration of their epic resistance had come from the quiet officer who stood there, straight and grave, in his white gloves and gala uniform. One must have been in the north to know something of the tie that exists in this region of bitter and continuous fighting between officers and soldiers. The feeling of the chiefs is almost one of veneration for their men, that of the soldiers, a kind of half-humorous tenderness for the officers who have faced such odds with them. This mutual regard reveals itself in 100 undefinable ways, but its fullest expression is in the tone with which the commanding officers speak the two words oftenest on their lips, colon my men. The little review over, we went on to Admiral Ronerk's quarters in the dunes, and thence, after a brief visit, to another brigade headquarters. We were in a region of sandy hillocks feathered by tamarisk, and interspersed with poplar groves slanting like wheat in the wind. Between these meager thickets the roofs of seaside bungalows showed above the dunes, and before one of these we stopped, and were led into a sitting room full of maps and aeroplane photographs. One of the officers of the brigade telephoned to ask if the way was clear to Newport, and the answer was that we might go on. Our road ran through the Oise Triangular, a bit of woodland exposed to constant shelling. Half the poor spindling trees were down, and patches of blackened undergrowth and ragged hollows marked the path of the shells. If the trees of a cannonaded wood are of strong inland growth, their fallen trunks have the majesty of a ruined temple, but there was something humanly pitiful in the frail trunks of the Oise Triangular, lying there like slaughtered rows of immature troops. A few miles more brought us to Newport, most lamentable of the victim towns. It is not empty as Ypres is empty. Troops are quartered in the cellars, and at the approach of our motor knots of cheerful Zouaves came swarming out of the ground like ants. But Ypres is majestic in death, poor Newport gruesomely comic. About its splendid nucleus of medieval architecture a modern town had grown up, and nothing stranger can be pictured than the contrast between the streets of flimsy houses, twisted like curl papers, and the ruins of the Gothic cathedral and the cloth market. It is like passing from a smashed toy to the survival of a prehistoric cataclysm. Modern Newport seems to have died in a colic. No less homely image expresses the contractions and contortions of the houses reaching out the appeal of their desperate chimney pots and agonized girders. There is one view along the exterior of the town like nothing else on the war front. On the left, a line of palsied houses leads up like Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.